Dr. Eric Chivian speaking at the annual Harvard Medical School lectures on biodiversity and human health. This is where we find out how things like climate change and toxins affect not only our world, but our own selves personally. The lecture was given February 16, 2006.
Well, species don't only give us medicines, they also are important medical research models. And let me tell you a little bit about that. Bear populations are threatened in many parts of the world, especially in Asia, because bears are hunted for their body parts. Some of the bear body parts are thought to have medicinal or aphrodisiac value. And this is a black market in Thailand. And here are bear gallbladders for sale. You can also see this horrible sign that tigers' penises are for sale. So there's a big trade in body parts from wildlife in many parts of Asia. There's also not just for medicines, but also for food. The whole SARS epidemic, as you recall, occurred in a part of China where eating wild animals was extremely widely practiced, especially if you had a fair amount of money. In any case, so bear gallbladders, some species can bring as much as 18 times their weight in gold, and therefore there's a huge market for them, and people are poaching them illegally. They're also milking a bile from live bears in very inhumane ways. But it turns out the bear is worth so much more than all the body parts, even if you calculated them in terms of gold. Consider the black bear. Black bears in winter months, this is our bear, this is our New England bear, enter a period of some 3 to 7 months where they den. They don't fully hibernate, but they go into a reduced state of metabolism. And during that time, they neither eat nor drink nor urinate nor defecate, and they don't really put weight on their muscles and on pulling on their bones. Yet they maintain a normal, essentially normal body temperature. It's somewhat reduced. They can be alert and reactive. They can deliver as many as 5 cubs and even nurse them, and they grow new tissues. Denning bears essentially recycle everything. For example, every mammal besides denning bears becomes osteoporotic if they're not active, if they're bedridden, for example, or paralyzed. You lose your bone mass. If we didn't move the way denning bears do for a period of 5 to 7 months, we'd lose as much as a third of our bone mass. They don't lose bone mass. They recycle the calcium, and they actually have some substance in their blood that inhibits the bone dissolving cell, it's called osteoclasts, and promotes the activity of the osteoblast to lay down new bone. So they stay in a stable situation with respect to bone. Well, osteoporosis in the United States affects some 34 million people and results in 1.5 million bone fractures. This is mostly postmenopausal women. 70,000 deaths every year from mostly broken hips. Costs the U.S. economy $18 billion a year. They don't urinate for up to 7 months. If we don't urinate for a few days, we're dead. People with chronic end-stage renal disease either have to have dialysis or they have to have a kidney transplant. There's no real treatment for chronic renal failure. They don't become toxic from their urinary waste, which they're making. They recycle their urea. They break it down and make amino acids, and they make new protein. Don't really fully understand how they do that. But if we understood that, we could perhaps have some clues about how to treat end-stage renal disease, which costs the U.S. economy $23 billion a year. Let's talk a bit about polar bears, because they're highly endangered. Not only are they at the top of the marine food chain, but they depend on the ice sheet, which is melting rapidly in the Arctic, to survive. When the ice sheet is intact, their bear's main food are seals. Ring seals are a major prey of bears, and they wait at the rare openings in the ice for the seals to come up for air, and they grab them and kill them and eat them. But when there's water all around, the seals can much more easily elude bears. And polar bears are starving, and there are many polar bear biologists who feel that they're probably not going to be in the wild by the end of this century, and maybe earlier. Well, species don't only teach us about biomedical things and about things in our bodies. I just want to mention this incredible building in Harare, Zimbabwe, that's modeled, this will please you, Ed, if you've never seen this, modeled after a termite nest. So termites in this part of the world are farmers. They grow a fungus in these big nests that you've seen. At temperatures that must remain a very constant 87 degrees, plus or minus a half degree Fahrenheit in the middle of this fungal farm, despite the fact that outside the nest, the temperatures can be as low as 35 degrees Fahrenheit at night and as much as 104 degrees Fahrenheit during the day. Well, they do this by a system of venting and humidity and very complicated airflow dynamics that this building in Harare is patterned after. And it uses one-tenth the energy of a building its size by modeling itself after this termite engineering. So I want to talk finally about ecosystem services. And these are the ways that species interact with each other and with the inorganic parts of their environment to provide essentially life support systems that keep all living things on this planet alive. We tend to take these services for granted, and yet we can't live without them. They purify our air and our water. They break down waste. They filter out pollutants. They pollinate plants. They keep soils fertile, et cetera, et cetera. Ed showed you this slide, slightly different version. Soil ecosystems are extremely complicated with a whole range of fungi and bacteria and protozoa and algae and worms and all kinds of organisms that are important for soil fertility. But let me talk about one ecosystem service, and that is essentially, this is a very anthropocentric point of view, but keeping human disease in check. And I want to mention the case of schistosomiasis. Well, schistosomiasis is an infection by a parasitic flatworm called a trematode or a fluke. It lives in freshwater ecosystems in the tropics. It causes very severe disease. There's some 200 million people are infected around the world. There's some 600 million at risk. And I tell the story because if you look at the life cycle of schistosomiasis and in a particular case study, which I'll mention, you can see how species, predators, can hold an organism in check that prevents a human disease from developing. Well, snails are very important. These are two snails in Lake Malawi that I'll talk about in a moment, but the snails release the larval agent of the trematode, which is called the Sicaria, that burrows into the skin of people and either develops in the gastrointestinal tract or in the genitourinary tract into an adult worm. In the case of the GU tract, the eggs are released in urine, and in the case of the gastrointestinal form species, it's released in the feces, which enter back into the water in certain parts of the world and start the cycle again, infecting the snail. Now, schistosomiasis was essentially not seen in Lake Malawi in the African country of Malawi prior to 1992. And at that point, two U.S. Peace Corps volunteers came down with severe disease. And then they started looking at people living around the lake. And in fact, they found that many people had evidence of schistosomiasis. And then they started looking at snails, and they found that so did the snails. And the story is actually quite complicated, but very interesting in terms of what we're looking at here. And that is that there's a major predator, probably more than one, in Lake Malawi of these snails. It's a fish, it's a cichlid fish called Trematocranus placodon. And this fish was being severely overfished. And the reason is population levels had increased around the lake. The corn crop in the year prior to this outbreak had failed, perhaps because of climate change in part. And people started fishing with malarial bed nets in Lake Malawi and became much better at it and started catching large numbers of this fish, this cichlid fish, which was a major predator for these snails. These snail populations exploded, these in particular, these two Balaenus species, and that seems to be the explanation for why there was an outbreak. So clearly there were schistosomes in this lake, but the snail populations were kept at such a low level that there was not disease. So what does all this mean, and what can be done about it? Well, for one, we have to look at these problems directly without avoidance or denial, no matter how difficult or frightening they are. That's what this class is about. We can't afford to bury our heads in the sand. We absolutely have to help people in the business world and in politics see that it's not a choice between a healthy environment or healthy profits. One can have both. Indeed, the only way we're going to have a healthy economy is to have a healthy environment. The costs otherwise are catastrophically great. And as we did with the Montreal Protocol that protected the ozone layer, the United States really has to take the lead in issues of biodiversity and greenhouse gas reductions. Do you realize that we have not even signed the Convention on Biological Diversity, which essentially every other major country in the world, all of our allies, have signed? We do not have a seat at the table at the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity. Largely, I'm sorry to say, because of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and its chair at the time, Jesse Helms. And no one has brought this up since then, which I think is a disgrace. And as you know, in terms of the Kyoto Protocol, we have not signed the Kyoto Protocol. Australia is the only other one of our allies who has not signed the Kyoto Protocol. We have 4 to 5% of the world's population. We produce some 25% of the world's greenhouse gases. And it seems to me that this administration, these are my views alone, I need to say they don't represent the center or anyone at Harvard Medical School, but this administration and people in Congress who should be looking at these issues, and some businesses like ExxonMobil and others should really begin to try to understand what's at stake here and put aside their political and other agendas. I had prepared a much greater rant, as some of you who know me know, but I've decided to, in the interest of time, to move along. But it may seem unusual for a psychiatrist like myself to be as angry at some of these people rather than understanding. And if anyone can tell me where I can find a bumper sticker for my car which reads, "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention," I would like to know. We can and we absolutely must invest the scientific effort and money on a scale similar to the Manhattan Project to develop renewable, non-polluting sources of energy, solar, wind, geothermal, to greatly increase our efforts at energy efficiency and conservation. We need to spend at least as much as we're spending on national security and terrorism, for that's really what we're talking about here. our collective security. Witness the heat wave during the summer of the year 2003 in France, which killed 18,000 people. That's six World Trade Centers. Look at Katrina, which killed thousands of people. We're talking about tremendous damage to our country and to people around the world, particularly poor people in developing countries who are going to be the most at risk. We've got to control our discharge of pollutants, particularly those that are long-lasting and accumulate in biological systems. We've got to slow down population growth and support efforts so that every woman in the world who wants it can have ways of controlling her birth rate, her reproductive rate. We need to protect biologically rich ecosystems, both in the oceans and on land. And we've got to consider that we're all a part of the problem and have to reduce our own consumption. Do we really need the devices in every new sharper image catalog? Shouldn't we be buying recycled everything? You can buy recycled toilet paper, paper towels, stationery, plastic bags, and shouldn't we be recycling everything we can of our own? Shouldn't we be driving small cars like this one instead of huge vans like that one? That's the same person in both photos. That's my wife, Jake, who's 5'11", but you can see how the difference in gas consumption. And I'm not going to get into another rant about SUVs, but I must say that I will consider it a really important achievement for myself if I'm able to convince even one person in this auditorium not to buy an SUV. We should be driving, well, not there. We should be driving that. That's right. I was going to show you my Prius again, but I thought that was too much. We should be walking, taking public transportation, biking. Each of us, we can make our own commitment to the Kyoto Protocol. Each of us can reduce our own energy consumption by 10%. It's not that difficult to do. Lower your thermostat at night in the winter in your house. Wear a sweater. Buy a down comforter to sleep under. Insulate your home better. Use more energy-efficient lighting. Don't use your air conditioning if it's cool out when you're driving, as so many people seem to be doing, pulling up the windows. If every household in California had replaced just 4 75-watt light bulbs with available compact fluorescents, the state would not have had to build 3 medium-sized power plants. And in the energy crunch in California, if you recall, in 2001, people reduced their electricity consumption by 11% across the state. This isn't rocket science. These are technologies that are available now. And there are all kinds of other things we can do. We can eat low on the food chain and avoid marine species that are endangered. The center has cards that tell you what marine species are sustainably harvested, and we will make those available to you. They're put out by Carl Safina and his Blue Ocean Institute. Carl's on our board. Don't eat carnivorously farmed fish. I'm sorry to tell you this, because I love salmon and shrimp as much as anyone in this room, maybe more. But farmed salmon eat 4 pounds, as much as 4 pounds, of wild-caught fish to make 1 pound of salmon. This is not sustainable. There's also concern, obviously, about PCBs, but this is not sustainable. You can buy herbivorous farmed fish, tilapia, catfish, and you can eat wild-caught fish that are sustainable. This card will tell you about them, things like mackerel, sardines. These are fish that actually are plentiful and also have high levels of omega-3s and low levels of pollutants. Eat less red meat, because some areas around the world are being cut down to make pasture for our hamburgers. It's not good for the environment. It's also not good for you. And if you do eat meat, eat organic meat, because meat has all kinds of stuff in it, pesticides, antibiotics, growth hormones. Actually, buy organic food as much as you can. I know it's more expensive, but what you're doing is encouraging this kind of sustainable agriculture. You're keeping these people in business, and it's better for you. Buy local seasonal food. The center is about to start a major program about eating local and doing the calculations about how much contribution to greenhouse gases we make in this country by eating food that has to fly thousands of miles to us. Don't buy Fiji spring water, for God's sakes, or water that comes from Iceland. You can buy Poland, Maine spring water if you want. But, you know, why do we need water that has to be flown with jet fuel and diesel fuel from trucks thousands of miles to get to you? It makes no sense whatsoever. Don't buy tropical hardwoods unless you know that they're being sustainably harvested, like teak and mahogany. And you actually can buy wood that has been recycled. And above all, become fully informed about these issues so that you can educate other people. And there's my bird slide. So I want to close with a final personal comment. And that is that every time I plant a seed in my garden and up comes a lettuce plant or an arugula or a cilantro, every time my apple trees blossom, and months later there are big, tart, crispy, juicy Roxbury russet apples, it's truly magic to me. From the song of the wood thrush singing in the dusk in a high canopy forest of central Massachusetts, to the smell of a lily of the valley or fresh-cut hay, from the beauty of an oriental poppy to the incredible feats of a common green darner dragonfly, flying at speeds of greater than 25 miles an hour, stopping on a dime, and instantly flying at the same speed in the opposite direction, to the ruby-throated hummingbirds I feed each summer, these 1.5-inch pipsqueaks migrating thousands of miles each spring and fall, their hearts beating many times a second, having to eat enough to keep them going, returning to the same spot, demanding that I put out the feeder for them, waiting for it. It's impossible for those who spend time outside observing these phenomena closely to not appreciate the incredible beauty and fascination of nature. And I believe we are incredibly lucky to be alive at this time in history, for the changes of the environment that Ed Wilson and I have spoken about are caused by our own behavior. And we have the ability, our generation, especially those of us in the most powerful country in the planet, especially those of us in this room who are among the most privileged and influential members of this society, we have the ability to turn this around. There are clearly evil people in the world, driven by greed and money and power, but almost everyone, even the most anti-environmentalist person who calls some of us wackos, they want to do the right thing. They want to make the world a better and healthier place for their children. They just don't know any better. They just don't understand the consequences of their actions. So it's a matter of education, and that's something that we can do. So it's up to us to provide this education, and I urge all of you in this class and after you leave this class and after you leave your educational settings at Harvard or MIT or BU or wherever, in your careers and in your personal lives, to join with us at the center and with the millions of others around the world and around this country to slow down the rapid trajectory of environmental degradation that we are on now, and to do everything in your power to protect the global environment and human health. Thank you.
Dr. Eric Chivian speaking at the annual Harvard Medical School Lectures on Biodiversity and Human Health. This is where we find out how things like climate change and toxins affect not only our world, but our own selves personally. The lecture was given February 16, 2006. You can watch the full series of lectures in streaming video at chge.med.harvard.edu/education/course_2006.